There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome, welcome to our first with Tom and Dave live stream conversation.
It's very exciting.
Yeah, this the day of the congressional UAP hearing in Washington. I am the Dave of the Tom and Dave, Dave Foley, and as you can see in the other window is Tom Wheeler.
I'm the Tom part in my undisclosed location.
Yeah, you do look mysterious.
Trying to add to the mood, just the mystery and the mood of it all, yeah, and the vibe is just a good UAP vibe going on.
You got a bit of the smoking man vibe from X-Files.
That's what I'm going for. I don't know how often we saw him in a denim shirt, but maybe when he went out at night.
Yeah, usually a nice conservative suit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I quit smoking, thank God. But thank you. I do. I want to have that air of mystery. And we had to go live because today was the hearings, the subcommittee of the House on National Security, and there were superstar guests that came to speak that were, this was mind-blowing. So we had to be joined by an expert, and we certainly scored on that front. So let me, I will introduce our guest and he will join us. Earl Gray Anderson is MUFON, State Director of Southern California. And for those of you who are not steeped in UFO lore, what is MUFON? Well, MUFON is the oldest and largest UFO organization in the world and the only one that has a corporate office with a full-time staff, has a distinguished board of directors, publishes the MUFON UFO Journal, holds an annual international UFO symposium to educate the public, has a membership of over 4,000 people, has a computerized UFO management system with over 100,000 UFO cases, and a structured field investigator training program with more than 600 active field investigators, a nationwide response team for high-value investigations known as the STAR Team, a trained underwater dive team, has its own television show on the History Channel called Hangar One, and its own subscription channel, MUFON TV, which may be included with one's membership to MUFON. And so Earl is a MUFON STAR team member, as well as an executive committee member of MUFON's ERT, and that's the Experiencer Resource Team. And in his work with MUFON, Earl has closed a plethora of high strangeness cases, one of which was presented as one of MUFON's cases of the year at the 2021 symposium. And this year, Earl hosted the Experiencer workshops for MUFON's 2022 Denver symposium, as he will be doing for the 2023 MUFON symposium. And he feels the Experiencer phenomenon is the beating heart of ufology. And we are thrilled to have Earl on with us. And let's welcome him to Really.
Hey, guys. How are you doing, Earl?
How are you?
Thank you so much.
I'm doing well.
Yeah. Oh, and he also has a glorious beard. and a mellifluous voice. So thank you for bringing both of those to our stream today.
It's great to have you, sir. And on what a historic day. I mean, we've been doing the podcast for a few, months now. Dave's been researching this for a few years, but you've been in this game for a bit. How validating was this for you just to see this event take place?
It was validating. Yeah. I'll say, I've got a little bit of cynicism when it comes down to officialdom and disclosure. And people are always asking me, when's disclosure going to happen? And I'll usually just say, well, it already did 2017 with Leslie King's article and, about the whole Tic Tac thing. But, I was kind of telling people, now don't get too excited. The first congressional hearing, they had the Fitzpatrick gentleman who was kind of playing the devil's advocate and tamping everything down. And I just kind of figured it was going to be like that again today. But nope, it was actually very, very good. Very forthcoming. Yeah,
very substantive. And I think I'm guessing for people who are coming to it as a blank slate, I can't even begin to imagine how much information that was to absorb and how mind-blowing it would be.
We got a lot to cover. We got a lot to cover on it. Because, I was like, in comparison, as you said, the NASA hearing, for example, was, they did a thing which was a little bit of a snoozer, and Kirkpatrick goes out there and sort of just dispels all hope of, we don't really have any proof of anything is really what he said, which is so blatantly. This was WrestleMania. I mean, as a hearing, this was a kind of just fireworks going off in all directions. And I'm just curious what are some of your guys' favorite moment? Like what were you most shocked to hear, I guess?
I think that, some of the people that were asking questions, like Ocasio-Cortez and of course, we know that Burchett has been, from Tennessee has had this interest in the phenomena. So I kind of expected that he was going to, ask good questions. But when they go into talking about actual bodies and crash materials and intact craft that apparently we have, I mean, that meme has been out there for many, many years.
Right.
But this is the first time where I've seen the rubber kind of hit the road on it. We may actually get some interesting information up forward here. So
I know, especially that, because I was slow to accept the notion of recovery programs and reverse engineering programs that were ongoing. And even though I've been hearing about them for a while, but to get it stated that bluntly was pretty startling. Although I was lucky, I've had some prep for almost a year now that this was coming. So
Chuck Schumer, the way that this amendment is written that he put out there, because historically I think the way that they've been able to keep things secret all this time is that they've farmed this stuff out to independent aerospace companies, right? Which industrial military complex, the definition of pretty much. But you can't put a request, a freedom of information request, in if it's a private company like that. And so nobody's had to pony up anything up until now. And the way that this amendment is written, they have to, they have to bring these materials and craft to Congress, or else prison terms and horrible, fines are up ahead for these guys.
Yeah. And they're also dragging it out of the Department of Energy exemption, which was the other place where they managed to bury stuff for so long, because our atomic secrets, if you hide it with our, if you bury this with our atomic secrets, then you can't get a FOIA. request in there.
And you bring up Schumer. Let's talk about that, because Schumer is the Democratic majority leader of the Senate, and yet you have this House hearing, which is run by is headed by Republicans, and the House is obviously Republican. And politics aside, it is, I think, truly worth emphasizing and putting exclamation points on the fact that this was one of the most, I was trying to think, I was like, maybe there was a hearing with Mr. Rogers where there was more bipartisan comedy and kind of kindness and compliments back and forth. Like, that was stunning to me that you have the bomb throwers of Congress. You've got Gates, you've got AOC, you've got Jamie Raskin, you've got, you know, and you've got Burchett, all of them typically on a daily basis are just volleying grenades at each other. And I was waiting for, I was like, who's gonna pick that kind of partisan moment to kind of throw water on this, or who's seeing, like, and to a person, almost entirely the approach was serious, kind of grave, bothered. They clearly believed in, and obviously these the people at the hearing, Grush, Favor, and Graves, were all had to be screened, right? They had to be, everyone could vote on them. They had been kind of tested, put up against all sorts of, you know, investigative anything to clear out anyone with any issues. So they obviously took these three witnesses incredibly seriously, and their questions were jaw-dropping. I mean, when AOC is saying, like, wait, so who, where's, what's the address of the place where the ship is? And Grush is like, I know the address. I will tell you in the closed setting. And of course you're like, oh shit, man, I want to hear it. But they were all like, where's the skiff? Like, open it. Like, let's go. Like, it was really, it was incredible to see. It was just, it was disclosure. I mean, disclosure was happening. I'm just sort of like, what compares historically to this hearing?
Nothing ever.
And I gotta ask,
the most transparency that we have seen on this subject ever. Officially. I've been looking back, you know, kind of racking my brain trying to think of anything comparable, and there really isn't anything comparable, you know. It was extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really, because you, one of the functions of MUFON, I think, maybe I'm wrong, but I think one of them is that you provide an ear to people who have had experiences, and an acceptance for people who feel maybe marginalized or even traumatized sometimes by their experiences. And so today must feel like a huge kind of a version of that, where suddenly we're getting this en masse acknowledgement for all of the people. Like, I'm sure the people that you've been dealing with over the years, especially in your experiencer group, I mean, this must be such a balm to the soul for them.
Yes, it's catharsis, you know, for people experienced deciding, or even from that, for those who have had face-to-face experiences with beings, forever and ever, they've been treated like, I mean, this is the way that the government decided to deal with the UFO phenomena, was by ridicule, bring out your top scientists, and more or less call these people crazy. So, I mean, it's been so ingrained in our society that, you know, if the subject would come up on any news program, unequivocally, you would hear the X-Files theme and little green men, you know, and rolling of eyes and giggle factor and all this. It's gone. I mean, this was treated with the proper amount of deference and seriousness that it's deserved since 1947 and earlier. Mm-hmm. It was quite astounding.
I was trying to think of in the same way that you were, like, what could have, I can't think of any congressional, I can't think of any hearings or committee hearings on this. I can remember what there was a press conference in the 50s with a bunch of military officials that were talking about the UFO swarm around Washington, yeah. D.C., which seemed like there was a very, you know, that seemed to
anniversary
be.
Anniversary of that today, by the is way.
You're kidding.
Today is the date that yeah. happened. The flyover of Washington, D.C., the second one, there was one a week before. And then the wow. second one, just to get their point across, I think our visitors came back, and yeah. and that today is the anniversary of that.
And it's so interesting,
July 26th.
Yeah, because on that event, you had pilots basically telling a similar story to what David Fravor told today, of going up to try and engage these whatever they were, and they were able to just disappear. And then, or they were able to surround a fighter pilot, and then, when he was trying to got to the point of, do I fire? What do I do? Then they were, they let him go. So there was,
they got their point across.
Yeah. That clear display of supremacy in the air, that happened in 52 and,
happened again.
Yeah.
In 2004.
How great is Fravor? I got to say, it was such a, three great witnesses. Like, Fravor is such a, there's just no airs about, he's not claiming to own any mystery. Like, he's really seems like just, and they were all great, but his kind of down to earth, do whatever you want with it. Like, and don't exaggerate it and just tell him what's there. And it's like, I didn't want to be here. And all of, it was just, you could tell that you just could tell they were having an impact on the people on the committee in real time. Like in real time, you could just see this sinking in. You could sense their feelings of duty to this and a sense that clearly they've already seen more. It was interesting. Matt Gaetz was going on about, all this stuff he had seen kind of on his own or been shown separately. I was trying to follow that. He's not even on the committee. He was there. He was just a guest. Mm-hmm. Not a fan personally, but I'm still trying to, I'm happy to have harmony, let them all kumbaya and talk about this and agree on the stuff. So I think hats off to all of them. I salute their diplomacy on the issue. And I think that is I pray that as the media interest inevitably grows snail-like as it is, and still ridiculously behind the events, I hope that the bipartisan energy continues when the cameras get hotter and the lights get hotter and everything, that the attention grows and it doesn't sort of turn into camps, because it obviously requires that sort of partnership, right? I mean, if this becomes a red blue thing, we're fucked. Respectfully.
Oh yeah.
Excuse my language, but
that's good to know. I can use.
I'll let them fly, let them.
Yeah,
but don't feel exactly like, what my wife said.
Yeah, don't feel like you have to be as big a potty mouth as Tom, though.
I can't help it. I get excited.
Yeah,
me too. I mean, to see AOC and Matt Gaetz there in the same room, and not beating on each other verbally. In the partisanship thing. I mean, this is the first time that we've seen these guys, work across the aisle with each other on a subject. And how strange and how delightful. Mm-hmm. If this is what actually gets us to stop demonizing each other ETs, if they can bring us together, and I think there is a desire in our visitors to see. I think that the way that we war with each other is perplexing, because here we are, our technology is way up here, but we're still fighting each other, literally warring, between countries at times. But also just the personal wars that we fight with each other just because of political ideal. And wow, I just really hope that this is contagious, that it spreads, and that maybe this will get us to work together and you know.
Yeah, I think maybe we're getting a little proof of concept of the scenario that Reagan put forward at the UN many years ago. You know, what if humanity was confronted by an alien presence? Would we forget our differences? And we're seeing that amongst people who maybe have the strongest differences in the country in that room today.
They're so diametric opposites. AOC and Matt Gaetz are diametrically opposite. And we all know that. But there they were, you know, same team and wanting disclosure. And that's amazing. Yes. I didn't foresee this. I had no idea that it would be like that today. And it was wonderful.
It makes me just so curious about what led to these hearings and why that energy exists. I mean, I guess it doesn't, I don't think everybody was play acting. In other words, I feel like the people, and I feel like the people on the committee don't already know the answers to their questions, or at least most of them don't know the answers to their questions. So there clearly is, to me, my gut told me they were legitimately curious and legitimately in the dark about a lot of this stuff. And yet there, do we think it's just the seriousness of the issue? I guess I'm just curious what you both think about the, like, how did that happen? How did they not go into their immediate roles and just start deciding, okay, well, this is a red issue, or there's more tracking on it on Fox than on CNN. So, but that's not happening. Like the Dems aren't just dismissing it and saying, okay, well, we'll be the science people and you guys are all crazy. That wasn't happening. And that's kind of what I was a little afraid might happen. What do you think that is? How did that happen?
I think it's the most important thing. It's so beyond just our personal political battles that we are not alone. There's another intelligence there, and that it's interacting with us. And that's the most important thing to me, other than God, maybe, you know, that you can really think about it. It's a personal thing. You look up at the night sky now, you're going to look whoever you are. If you're aware of what went on and the things that were said and were talked about, you're going to look at that much, much differently than you did before. But I think that that it's that deep of an issue. It's a personal issue for people. So I think that's probably what caused that to happen. Doesn't matter what your background is, what your political stripe is, what your, you know, it's very, very deep.
Yeah. And I think the people, the people who are writing legislation, people like Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, and the people who organized this hearing, I posted something yesterday about it, but that we're in a sense seeing a negative impression of the confidential information that they already have. So as I said, it's like, you know, like we're seeing the footprint and they've seen the foot.
And so
everything we can draw inferences about what, whether it's, you know, Burchett or Marco Rubio or Chuck Schumer, we can draw inferences about what information they have based on the actions they're taking.
They mentioned in the hearing about, you know, and again, you know, it's, I mean, so the presidents that have seen UFOs were Reagan, Jimmy Carter, George W. Bush was the head of the CIA, and it's kind of known that he was in the know. He knew about this stuff. The Clintons, of course, John Podesta, there was that great interest there. And some, you know, it's kind of well known that Hillary Clinton sort of wanted to be the disclosure president. That was something she wanted to do. you know, there was interest there with her husband for the same thing. You know, apparently the first thing he asked when he got in office is, you know, bring me the files on UFOs, bring me the files on the JFK assassination. So that interest was there. Now, Harry Reid, he's the guy that acquired the $22 million that funded, you know, the NIDS, the Skinwalker Ranch investigation that Congress was actually aware of and supported. And of course, you know, sadly, we lost Harry Reid a couple years ago. But Chuck Schumer was a very close friend of Harry's, and so he's carrying on that work. So you got, you know, you look at this with, you know, these people, they have been read into a lot of these, you know, the SAPs, you know, the programs that the rest of us can't read about. So, you know, I think that it's finally just coming to the surface. The toothpaste is out of the tube. There's no way to put it back in. Now they just have to deal with how do you tell the public this and not cause panic?
Yeah,
that's their big concern. And not share technology that may, you know, that may empower our enemies in the world, right? I mean, I understand what the concerns are, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, my mom worked in officialdom and very early on. And I heard about this when I was a little kid, you know. I mean, my mom kind of did a little disclosure number with me, and she wasn't supposed to. Mm-hmm. But she told me emphatically, she said, and she wanted to, you know, she didn't repeat herself. She was very concise about things that she said. She said, Earl, they will never, ever, ever, ever tell the public about this. And I asked her, I said, why? This was back in 1977 after we went to see Star Wars. My mom started, you know, one of the few times where she kind of broke her NDAs, you know, non-disclosure agreements.
What was mom's job or
let's back that up a little
company. Let's find out how you got into this deal, Earl. let's get to it.
It's generational.
Yeah, you share that a little bit with our friend Paul Hynek. Mm-hmm. You've kind of grown up with this issue.
Yes,
but tell us about who your mom worked for.
My mom was one of Howard Hughes's private secretaries. She worked out here at Hughes Aircraft over, you know, you see Howard Hughes Parkway and all that, you know, in Los Angeles. But she worked for Hughes, and they used to communicate. He was already a germaphobe. This is like 1955 or so. So they would communicate like Charlie's Angels with a little intercom system. So my mom only saw him in person one time, although her office was right next to his. But yeah, anyway, apparently he trusted my mom. My mom was very good. She had a knack for telling when somebody was lying or not. She was very good at that. And that was a real problem when I was a teenager. But anyway, my mom said that they didn't tell her where they were taking her. They sent her on a little assignment with a security detail. She didn't tell me where this happened. This was 1963 when my mom told me the story, by the way. I was 5 years old, and I remember it really, really well. Made quite an impact on me. She said that they took me out to the desert, and there were a couple of security guys with me, and there was nothing there except this shack. It was a concrete bunker. It's kind of low slung to the ground with a door, nothing else, no windows, no other features, no signage, you know, didn't say extraterrestrial highway or anything like that. And so they took her into this building, and there was an elevator. So she got in with the elevator with these guys. She thought it might go down a floor or two. And she said it just kept on going. And she said that the doors opened up, you know, a mile down, that the doors opened up finally. And she said there was a little city down there, Earl. You know, there were these guys that lived down there pretty much. A lot of rocket scientists, German rocket scientists. So I think this was probably a part of the Operation Paperclip, where we acquired so many of the German rocket scientists that Russia did. We kind of divvied them up. She said that the door opened up and there was a little city under the desert that they got around in golf carts. She said they had little cafes down there. They had a movie theater. They had a bowling alley. She said that they had a barber shop, but the guy knew how to do her hair for her because she liked to have her hair permed. So apparently people were staying down there for long periods of time. And so she told me this crazy story. You know, it's 1963, Venice, California. And then she kind of, at the end of the conversation, almost like an afterthought, she said, "Oh, by the way, son, UFOs, flying saucers, that's a real thing. And we know that we're not alone in the universe. We've already made contact, that there is extraterrestrial life out there. And I grew up with that." You know, and that's, I guess that's
a lot on for a 5-year-old to absorb.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She talked about it a couple of times. But then horror of all horrors, when I was in fourth grade, I started really getting interested in this. You know, I was really thinking about what my mom told me. And we had like, what do your parents do? Show and tell Fridays. Right. So I went up. And I told my dad's story, you know, and then I told my mom's story, my mom, and I just told them what I told you. And by the way, UFOs and extraterrestrials are real. So the teacher, and now the teasing factor happened with me. This is when I started getting laughed at. People would do, you know, my favorite Martian, you know, antennae behind me and stuff, you know, and there's a lot of teasing. So the teacher called my mom in, and I'll never forget the drive home. We're driving home, and my mom was very, very quiet. And then she says, "Earl, you can't ever, ever, ever talk about what I told you about the little city under the desert and UFOs, for God's sakes." And she keeps, you know, she's trying to drive the car. You know, it was maybe just a mile away to get home. But then she turns around, she looks at me, she says, "My God, how did you remember that? You were just a bee." But I did, you know, I mean, it just, and I do have a good memory. I mean, my first memory is from when I was like 3 years old, when we were in a car accident. Not as good of a memory. But my mom, then she proceeded to say, she said, "If you can't ever talk about this, people don't know about little cities under the desert. They don't know about UFOs. And your mom wasn't supposed to tell you this. It's a secret." And then she looked at me and she said, "Your mom could go to prison if you ever talk about this again."
Wow. First up, that's amazing leverage to have over your mother.
I don't think I used it. You know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I want to stay up late tonight, Mom. Maybe I, you know, maybe my lips get a little loose.
Yeah, I'm getting on the horn. That beats my first grade Santa Claus disclosure story, which I caught absolute hell for, from teachers and parents coming in yelling at me. But that the secret city is better, and the fear of prosecution, indeed, higher stakes than Santa.
I had a guy from the DOD, because you kind of meet interesting people when you state director of MUFON. But this one gentleman told me, "You know, I've read your mom's file, and we knew about you. Your mom actually reported on herself when you went and you gave your little speech at school."
Wow. Wow.
And then he said, "You know, you could be very proud of your mother. She didn't lie to you. And she was a patriotic American, and you can be very proud of her." And okay, it's like, "Well, can you read me a little bit more?" It's like, nope, it's sealed.
So she wasn't offering you up for prosecution.
No.
Oh, good. That's good.
Like, was she?
But she, after, you know, I think she was afraid that word would get back, and that she was patriotic, and she believed in what she was doing. She thought it was the right thing.
Did she work for the DOD?
A headhunter for aerospace. I don't know what 3 acronyms she was working for. As far as I know, you know, it was Hughes Aircraft, but I'm sure that they went in there. I mean, I know that her security clearances were up through the roof because she was proud of that. You know, on her bed, she, you know, she again reiterated that you know, I've kept my security clearances through all these years, and I'm very proud of it. She got my ex-mother-in-law a job at the FBI, actually, or she got and she was already my ex-mother-in-law, but she knew about my mom through, you know, my ex-wife. And she needed to get security clearances because she wanted to work with the FBI, which she wound up doing. So she said, "Do you think your mom could help me? I don't even know how to proceed with that. You know, it's just out of my orbit." So my mom, you know, makes a few phone calls, and the next thing I know, you know, I'm getting a call from my ex-ma-in-law saying, "Thank you very much, girl, and thank your mother again for me because I got the job at the FBI."
Wow.
It's very nice of her. Sometimes the mother-in-laws don't get along quite that well, particularly in the ex situation. So that's a good person right there. There's something you said that I found really interesting, which is, what is the DOD MUFON communication? Like, what is that exchange like? How has that come up for you? And what are some, what can you tell us about that?
Has it evolved significantly in the last few years, I imagine?
I'm sure. I mean, I know that they're very interested in MUFON, and there's probably people in MUFON that have that connect, but I don't know who or what. We're not against the government. We're not, that's the way I feel. I mean, I've told people before, let me know if I'm saying stuff I'm not supposed to say. You know, I never signed any non-disclosure agreements, but I don't want to, you know, harm my country, for God's sake, national security. So far, nobody's told me to shut up, so I keep on doing what I do.
Do you have a reporting mechanism? I mean, or is there something like in terms of your casework, or, you know, something that require, like, you guys got to check this out? I mean, what is that like?
You mean, I'm not sure if I understand the question. For the person on the street?
Well, I'm just wondering, does MUFON report to the government significant sightings, or is there somebody you speak to? Is that something that you consider an important part of the mission?
Yeah. Well, we've been meeting in a secured SCIF. It began apparently it was quarterly, and from what I hear from headquarters is it's ramped up a little bit, and I think it's probably David McDonald or some of the people that are, you know, the leaders at MUFON. But yeah, there's been transparency with us in sharing cases because of this great interest. And I think we saw the culmination and the fulfillment of that today. Hopefully that's just the first note of the following symphony, you know, that we're going to see a lot happen.
Yeah. And what we were talking earlier, you thought they might have been referencing a case that you closed recently. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. I would love to. I have to redact names and stuff because I don't want to. The guy is still a pilot, you know, working for a major airline. But I had this case. It was 6-7 months ago. In this commercial flight, it was over Santa Cruz Island here, you know, the Channel Islands, and they saw this UFO they call it the racetrack UFO. And it had been reported by some other pilots. And it was very interesting. It was up in low Earth orbit, and it was doing sort of like the circular oval kind of flight pattern. And that was the thing that he was reporting because it was local and it had just happened. And it was interesting. It was a good case where radar hits on it, and there were two other commercial jets that reported it as well. But then he started mentioning that, that wasn't the first sighting I ever had. I'll just read from his report. This is his own words. He said, "My initial sighting was on February 12th, 2005. We were flying at 39,000 feet elevation out of back to Honolulu, Hawaii." These guys were coming from Japan. It's a JAL flight, apparently. "There were three of us, myself, the co-pilot and our flight engineer. And I have to redact their names. I don't want to get anybody in trouble here. I'm retiring next year. I've noticed that the airline I currently work for seems to be backing off from warning us not to repeat UAP sightings. So I decided to put in a MUFON report on this. I was piloting a DC-10, Flight 58, for Japan Air Charter Airlines, a subsidiary of JAL. We were flying out of Fukuoka, Japan, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, back to Honolulu. I'd flown this route many, many multiple times, so I'd never done anything that I couldn't explain before this happened. In fact, I didn't believe that UFOs were a real thing. But at 1421, Zulu time, in the early morning, past the international gate line, you could just see a little fingernail of blue at the horizon line, but everything else was pitch black. We were cruising along when the next thing you know, something catches my eye right around 10 o'clock off the nose of the aircraft, 30 degrees azimuth. I saw something. At first, just a flash of light, light reflecting off of something. But then I saw it, and I pointed it out to my crew members, and I said, "What the hell is that?" The pilot said, "What?" And I pointed directly at what I saw and said, "That." Sure enough, there were three huge, and I mean huge, disks that had come up into the upper atmosphere, glinting the sun off of their surfaces far above the horizon line. I mean, they were so far up, they were technically still in space. They hadn't really entered atmosphere yet. And when you're up at 39,000 feet, you can see stuff. For instance, when the space shuttle did their tether experiment, we could see that happening from up there. Anyway, objects were very large because they were at least 100 miles away from it. I would estimate that each silver disk must have been a good couple hundred feet across, and that's downsizing, if anything. No surface features that you could see, no bubble on top, just three metallic disks glinting the sun. They were in a tight equilateral triangular formation. There weren't any lights on them that I could see, just their mirrored surfaces unwavering like chrome, reflecting back the light from a high altitude, basically. We watched them, and as they came in, they stopped, and you could see them reorient themselves, or the exact same distance from each other. They sat there for around 10 seconds like that, hovering in a tight triangular pattern. And when the UFOs took off, they didn't have to accelerate to speed. They just took off instantaneously at an incredible speed. And they shot off down past the horizon line so you couldn't see them. Now, it was bizarre. You know, we're used to accelerating up to speed, but these objects left suddenly all at once. And if I hadn't been looking at them, I would have thought that they had just blinked out of existence, disappeared. But no, you could see them shoot off together, but just at an unimaginable speed. A flight crews come and go. I don't really keep in touch with past crews I've worked with, but the three of us sort of bonded over having seen this. We stay in touch as three of witness something that they say does not exist. But we saw this with our own eyes. It changed the way that I look at the stars at night, changed the way that I look at everything.
Wow.
And they mentioned during the hearings that there were flight crews that had seen UFOs in that pattern from Japan to Hawaii. And I haven't ever received any other cases similar to that. I mean, I've had lots of pilot sightings, but that was the only one that I've heard of from Japan to Hawaii. And since it was a recent case and they've been taking these cases to Congress, I'm kind of figuring that that was the case that they were referencing today. And it's a
good one. Oh, it's a good one. Did they happen to get any visual anything? Were they?
It's before iPhones and all that stuff. But what I do have is a photograph of the log book, which I, yeah, I mean, I write a regular column for Outer Limits magazine, which is a British mag. And that was, interestingly enough, that was my submission for this month's column. I just submitted it maybe 4 days ago, and there it, they're talking about this and at the hearings today, which I
that seems to be one of about. Yeah, totally. And that seems to be one of the areas that they need now to augment is commercial pilot reporting, right? Because it's basically like the local cops, wherever, I don't know who the local cops are when you're flying from Honolulu or, you know, Japan to Honolulu or who you call, you know, the Coast Guard, I guess, but they don't seem to have that mechanism to, you know, get reporting. I mean, to go just to the hearing for a second, there was this laundry list of things that the chairperson, I know Bruchette was talking about, like, well, obviously this will lead to legislation. Obviously this is just the beginning. Obviously we're going to do multiple hearings. Mm-hmm. What do we think comes next? Earl, what do you think is most needed in terms of, reporting, or where do you feel the need is most right now?
I think that the greatest need right now, because now we have the story, the general populace has this story, you know, and maybe the year before, but it was just, you know, on some silly radio show or, you know, science fiction or whatever. But now this has been officiated and taken seriously by Congress. So what I'm hoping is that they're able to get some of these insiders that are working on these special access programs that are, you know, black programs, or, you know, the public doesn't know about it. Most of the people in government don't know about it. 60% of the military budget unaccounted for, right? They talked about that today, and this is what it is. And so I'm hoping that they're able to get people now that have had hands-on, first-hand witnesses who have seen the bodies. I hope we get that. I hope we get photographs. I hope we get videos. We know they're sitting on video after video after. They've been doing that forever and ever. And now we don't want the public to be afraid. And they're going to have to take care in how they present this, so that it doesn't become something where people are, you know, people just tend to think the worst, you know, that could happen.
Right.
And they become alarmists. And so they're going to have to be careful how this is divulged to the public. But I think that we need to know. I hope that after this, that we're not going to see any more of our made, you know, well-known scientists coming out and making fun of UFOs or laughing at witnesses. And so that's what I hope happens, is now I hope that there's a reveal where people can have eyes on and can see the actual materials, bodies, and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Feels like there also needs to be, I know you do a lot of work with experiencers. One of our upcoming episodes, a dear friend of mine had a chilling, traumatic, fascinating experience. And it feels like these people have been completely sort of shut out, because it's so personal, it's too, you know, it's too crazy or whatever, you know, and in the meantime, people have been through something really traumatic. And the more public disclosure that takes place, the closer you get to this realization that, oh my.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
God, this is, these people, this is, it becomes even more, the awareness grows that this happened to people or is happening to people, more people than we probably can believe or understand or comprehend. What do you think would be the best outcome for them, or how do you think this hearing could possibly help people who are experiencers?
Just that the ridicule factor is tamped down. You know, the Robertson panel, they convened in 1953 after the July 26th, flyover of the White House. They convened, you know, how do we deal with this? How do we deal with it in public? And it was unequivocal. What they came up with was ridicule them, bring out our top scientists and tell everybody that this is impossible, and just make them look foolish. Make people think that people who have had encounters are crazy. And so I hope now that people see that this is serious business. And I don't think that our visitors are here to do air shows and show off their technology. That's not what this is about. And I think that the contact thing, you know, my great mentor at MUFON is Kathleen Martin, and her aunt and uncle were Betty and Barney Hill. The first well-known, just full-on abduction story that ever, it was in Look magazine. I remember my aunt brought the magazine over for my mom. It was like 1967, I think, when it came out. So, of course, myself and my three cousins were out playing. We were playing Lost in Space or something. I remember we had like the little space monster toys in the backyard. And we hear this kind of noisy conversation coming from the kitchen. So we sneak up there and we're doing this number, trying to listen to what, you know, my mom and their mom were arguing about. Well, she had brought the Look magazine over, and it had the Hill story about the abduction. And we were listening like in the middle of the conversation, and my aunt is telling my mom, well, this can't be true. She said, it's just like bad science fiction. They say that they stuck a needle on this woman's navel. Now, I turned to my older cousin, I said, what's a navel? You know, and he's like, belly button, shut up. Yeah. But it became very personal at that point. You know, I remember, because before that, my only idea of extraterrestrial life was like the Great Gazoo from the Flintstones or some silly thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And here, you know, my mom is speaking with authority and knowledge that this is not something that she heard about. You know, her sister, my aunt, was asking her because she thought that she would know. And my mom said that, as far as I know, this sounds like this could very well have happened. Wow. This could very well have happened. I don't think that these people are lying.
Yeah, no. And I think that's one of the side effects, I think, of it was a progression where, I realized one day, all right, so I fully accepted that there's these craft flying in our airspace and that they're real, and that the evidence is overwhelming that these things are real. And then I had to sort of take myself aside and have a word with myself and say, all right, well, if that's real, why are you so slow to believe in the abduction phenomenon? How is that a big leap of faith to go from these craft are in our airspace, they're piloted by somebody, they're picking people up and having a look at them, because it would seem almost less believable that they weren't doing it. It's
here for a reason. And people say, well, why don't they land on the White House lawn? Well, that would cause panic. They'd probably shoot at them. There would be, you know, it would be partisan, whoever happened to be the president at the time. But that it's this one-on-one contact thing that's going on. And I think that it's shocking. I mean, Dr. John Mack was a PhD that studied this phenomenon early on, the abduction visitation phenomenon. And he used the term ontological shock. And that is what people are left with when they've had an experience. And a lot of people have experiences. I mean, I had one myself. I don't know. If we want to talk about that,
I would. Yeah, we'd love to. If you're willing to talk about it.
But Paul was saying, okay, when Paul Hynek was on, I'm sorry to me to talk over you.
Please talk over him. We insist. But
Paul was saying that with his father, you know, that he hadn't seen a UFO, and actually he did. You wound up reminding him. Yeah, Dr. Hynek did actually see a UFO, and I believe he saw one again when he was in a flight in a plane. He thought it might have been a UFO. But he was saying that it's better if a researcher is just a straight ahead scientific researcher without that, you know, personal background. And that's the way that when I went into this, I had no idea that I would wind up having an experience myself. And I thought the same way. Well, that, you know, after I did have an experience, I didn't tell people because there's the ridicule factor. I'm a researcher, you know, I'm a field investigator, and maybe people will not take me as seriously if I start talking about alien abduction. You know, it's like the skit on Saturday Night Live where, you know, well, yeah, they took me and then they did this horrible thing. And, you know, you don't, you know, people tend to look at you funny. Mm-hmm. But I did have an experience where, and my mom, you know, she told me about an experience she had when she was 16 years old with an intelligently controlled, pretty much like a Foo Fighter. So the band got their name from a UFO that people were seeing during World War II. They would follow our planes. In fact, my dad was a B-17 tail gunner, and he said, oh yeah, we saw those things as some German secret weapon.
Yeah.
And Germans were saying it was our secret weapon. But my mom was, she was getting ready to go to sleep, and she and her sister, the same one that was arguing about Look magazine, they would sleep on the screened-in porch. They lived in Iowa, Muscatine, Iowa, is where my mom grew up. And her sister was already asleep. My mom was kind of on her elbows, and she hears this buzzing sound like a hive of bees. And she looks over, and she said that it was about the size of a beach ball, and it was just pure sparks. And the thing came right through the screen intact, went and hovered over her sister at first, just hovered there. And she was sleeping soundly. And then it came over to my mom. She said that it was like eye off, and it had eyes. It was just right in front of me, and it just sat there like it was looking at me or something. And then it went back through the screen. My mom said that she got up and she ran through the door, you know, opened the door and ran after it. And it was like waiting for her in the neighbor's adjoining cornfield. There's a good science fiction, you know, image for you, you know. But there it was waiting for my mom about 30 feet in the air. And she said she got there and she's looking up at it, and it raised up a little bit higher, and then it popped like a soap bubble and smelled like ozone. Although she used the word, she said it smelled like your electric train transformer, Earl. And she told me, you know, this was, now she didn't make the connection that this was some kind of intelligent life. She always referred to it as her ball lightning incident. But the problem with that is it was acting intelligently, and it was waiting for her, and it was looking at her sister. And I think that this phenomenon is personal. We may wish that it was just, you know, like us studying, you know, lions in the wild or something. And I guess, you know, there is similarities, you know, we'll tranquilize a lion, we'll tag their ear and monitor them and see how their health is and all that stuff. But anyway, when I first became a field investigator for MUFON, I tried this thing that they call CE5 meditation. And now I'm not like a big proponent. I mean, there are people that will charge you to do this, and don't pay anybody to do that for you, because you can do it yourself. But I had meditated as a youth, and I knew how to do it. And I thought, what the heck? You know, I'm going to try it. I didn't really take it very seriously. But I started sending the message out, I want to meet you. And in fact, you can actually abduct me if you want. Yeah. And, well, I don't, you know, I would not encourage anybody to try that because it worked. Now, we were living in Burbank, California at the time on the Chandler bike path. If you know where that is, it's
oh, very
a busy
well,
area.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not rural. It's, you know, busy there.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway, I had closed a MUFON case I was working on. It was about midnight. Went upstairs. You know, we had like a little bungalow bedroom. I'm on my elbows, kind of like my mom described that she was when she saw her, you know, Foo Fighter. This weird thing was happening. Our room started filling with light. It wasn't coming from a source. It wasn't coming from outside. It wasn't coming from, a light downstairs. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, a smartphone or anything like that. It was just the slowly grew brighter and brighter in our room. My wife was dead of the world asleep, just like my aunt was when my mom had her experience. I'm a scientifically minded man. But for some reason, it was just like, oh, it was all copacetic. It was fine. You know, it was, you know, I it was like I felt peaceful. We had a cricket problem in the rafters. It's an old house. Well, you couldn't hear any crickets, couldn't hear any external sounds. It was like a quiet room in a recording studio. Time became strange. It's like a minute to an hour didn't matter. There is this object that I saw that was in front of our television set, in front of our bed, almost like this little spinning wheel, or, you know, it was just this sepia colored 7 foot across spinning motion that I was watching. I mean, I was awake. I wasn't asleep. You know, this wasn't sleep
paralysis. You're saying to yourself at this point, given all of your history with research and what's happening?
I was a new researcher at the time.
Oh, okay. I'm just saying, what's happening in your mind? Are you thinking this is what this is? Are you thinking?
I wasn't under my own cognizant control at that point. Okay. I mean, when this happens, you're subject to, you're highly suggestible. And sure. I realized that I couldn't move. It was the first thing that started scaring me. All right. So I'm trying to move. But there I am. I had pillows stacked behind my back because I kind of like to sleep that way. Semi-recumbent, you know. Now I'm a retired nurse. I used to take care of quadriplegics. I did that for 35, 40 years almost. And I you know, retired a couple years ago. The last that I would want to be is a quadriplegic. And that's what I was. I couldn't move a muscle. The spinny thing that was in front of us, it was like somebody had poured cream into a cup of coffee. It opened up from the center outwards. It was very bright. I could see distance. Our neighbor's house was like 10, 15 feet away. So there was no room to park a spaceship there. Okay. Mm-hmm. No room whatsoever. But somehow or another, I was just totally accepting of it. It was just, this was just the state of mind that they got me into. Now I watched these, you'd call them the small grays, maybe 3.5 to 4 feet tall. They draw towards me. They didn't walk up. It was almost as though somebody was pulling them up on a carpet or something. They just pulled up to me and, they took blood from me. It was very methodical. It was almost like a surgical team. The four of them moved in tandem, and there was no communication that I could hear, no verbiage. And it took about 15 minutes to do what they were doing. And I was trying to make contact. I was trying to speak to them in my mind. And it was nothing, no answer, no nothing.
What are you trying to say?
Well, I was like, why are you doing this and help? And, you know, what is this about? You know, and I was scared because they were taking a lot of blood from me. I was afraid they were going to. Now, I knew enough about the experiencer phenomena. I had read Bud Hopkins and a few other of these researchers that usually somebody, if they're in the situation, they're given a calming message. But I wasn't getting anything. There was no telepathy coming back. And so I was afraid that I would be like one of those exsanguinated cows that they find by the road, you know, because I wasn't getting like a message, you're going to be okay. But I was okay. You know, I mean, I felt very weakened. I felt lethargic, like I had given too much blood at the blood bank. They drew away the same way that they drew in. They just went backwards. They kept staring at me. They didn't really move. They just kept on looking at me. Big black eyes, you know? And it's like, you know, beware if you look into the abyss, you know, because the abyss may look back. Well, that's what it felt like. There's just a power in that eye-to-eye contact when they make that. And I think that they use that. I just saw them draw backwards. The hole in the wall came back together, and the light was dimming. It was getting dark in our room again. And as soon as I could move, I started shaking my wife and yelling and screaming. It's like, oh my God. And you know, I don't even remember what I said, but I'm sure it was aliens and took right. my blood. And my wife's reaction was, oh my God, you have joined this crazy UFO group. Is this the sort of thing that I have to look forward to? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I went into like a fetal position. I was just confused. I didn't know what to think about it. I didn't know. It was embarrassing. You know, I mean, my own wife thought that I'd had a mental breakdown. Not luckily, but two nights later, the shoe was on the other foot. I was dead asleep and my wife is shaking me awake.
Oh my God.
And again, our room was flooded with light with no source. I mean, light doesn't work like that. You have a source, the photons go out. And, but this was the same thing. And she starts pacing by the bed. I've never seen her do that before ever. You know, my wife has a lot of composure to herself. But she was very aggravated, very upset. And she goes, oh, my God, Earl, you need to tell your little friends they need to leave us the fuck alone.
Oh, my God.
See, I got my F-bomb in there. That's
yeah. usually well, that was a good one. That was yeah. that was a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She said, you know, you need to tell your little friends. Now, I didn't tell her what they looked like. All right. I didn't say anything. Right. I was embarrassed. She thought that I'd gone nuts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't sign up for this, she said, you know. Two nights after that, we both woke up. This time the light was coming from outside our house. We go to the window. There's like God's own spotlight shining down on our house in the middle of Burbank. You know, it wasn't in the news.
This is a third night.
Trifecta of strange nights. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is when I found out that the phenomena, it's not just some distant thing that's, you know, tagging our ears or whatever, but there's this deep interest. And I think that it's personal. And I think that they do this from person to person rather than in mass that would maybe cause us to rebel or, you know, riot in the streets or, you know, turn it into a religion or any number of the human ways that we react to, you know, the ineffable out there. I think that this one-on-one thing is how they operate. Mm. To me, it seemed like it was this horrible, scary thing after it had happened, but I started noticing that my empathy had been changed. I started feeling people's feelings. When people would tell me their experiencer stories, suddenly I was feeling it. I could feel their fear or their joy or their, you know, it was right there. I also started experiencing synchronicities, which Carl Jung came up with that term, but it technically means a meaningful coincidence. And it happens all the time. I mean, we were talking about your friend CJ, who's now working as my field investigator. I mean, that's a synchronicity. We didn't have any connection, and suddenly we find out that, you know, one of your dear friends from the 1990s is now like my brand new field investigator. She took the test and she did beautifully, and
yes,
she's going to start getting cases.
Yes, you know, and yes, and that occurred just before we had gotten you to agree to be on this stream tonight, which is
weird, huh?
Which none of us knew. Yeah.
I'm used to this stuff now, you know, I mean, yeah. I try not to take it for granted, but it's just kind of part and parcel of this phenomenon. They're not here to do air shows. They're here to change humanity, I believe. I think they're trying to get us to change.
They may have accidentally kickstarted some religions in the past, so maybe they're more on guard against that. Maybe they've seen how badly we handle religions. Oh. So they're a little more.
What has been now. I find that amazing on so many levels, and thank you for sharing it. I think it's important for people to obviously share them, and I know that's such a primary part of your work. Is being someone just to listen, right? Just to hear them and say, okay, yeah, exactly. And the similarities to my friend's story is so interesting, and the same feelings and the same, I think that is as scary as it is, because I agree with you. The intimacy of this is alarming. Yeah. It's not something in a distant quasar, that all these things you have to think about mathematically to make it. It's the closeness and proximity that is, I think a growing consensus building around this idea of maybe we're sharing space, maybe with them that, it, you know, or maybe they're just much more next door than we can perceive even. But the idea of this one-on-one, right? Because so many people just have someone sitting, laying, sleeping next to them, not having the same experience, you know, not aware. That's just one of the crazy parts of it.
And also, as Tom's friends had, and you, I mean, your story too, there's a multi-generational aspect.
I was going to say.
It's multi-generational. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the fact that your mother had that experience, and then some, and then another synchronicity that her career path takes her into contact with.
I know. That's so fascinating.
You know,
it's wild. And I see this in cases, you know, I'll ask people sometimes, well, were either of your parents in the military or in any special access programs themselves? And you'd be surprised how often I hear that. And I think there's concern for us. I think that things have ramped up more recently, because here we are, our technology is way up here. You know, but we're still acting like warriors. I mean, we're kind of a warrior caste species. I mean, war follows humanity. That's our technology. Yeah. I mean, that's even like the UFO technology that could make our lives easier. You know, whether that's like something that would replace petroleum being base of fortunes and how we get around and operate and stuff, that would change, you know? And I think that there's CERN, that once we get out there, that we're going to become Star Wars instead of Star Trek. I think that we're a dangerous species. So I think that is perhaps what's going on, is that people are being changed in a core way, in a personal way. And it changes you. I mean, people, whether they, you know, have this benevolent experience or something that was scary, like what I had, that you're left with, or it engages certain gifts, I think, that humans are probably born with, but we are kind of a disabled race. I mean, all these other, you hear contact reports, and there's always telepathy going on. And it seems to be the way that the communication happens. you can't lie to somebody if you're telepathic. You can't rob them blind. You can't steal from them, and you can't tell them some BS story. So how much differently would humanity be if we could actually read each other's minds? I think that it would change everything.
Or even just as you discussed, an elevated sense of empathy. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, isn't telepathic, but if we had slightly more capacity for empathy, how it would change us.
Just a sense of what's going on, you know, what people are dealing with.
Yeah. And also, speaking of empathy, seems to me like that you would lean towards the notion that these creatures that are visiting, assuming they're visiting,
might be their planet, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
That they have some form of empathy with us as a species.
Yes, I believe so.
I just watched recently a debate between John Mack and Bud Hopkins.
That must have been fun.
It was very interesting, but they had very different views about the aliens. Yes. John Mack did see this as something that could be in ways not just benign but beneficent in their contact with human beings. And Bud Hopkins was just, I want these fuckers gone. These fuckers should just leave us alone.
Check this out.
Yeah.
So who do you report something like this to? All right. When I had my experience, I, you know, had my state director at the time, and he was kind of some bolts guy back then. Now he's changed and he knows it's different. You know, a lot can happen in 7.5 years. But I told him, I confided in him. I drove all the way out to San Luis Obispo, where he lived, to tell what happened. And he was kind of like rolling his eyes. That was the last thing he wanted to hear, was his new field investigator saying that he had an alien contact experience. I got a hold of Peter Robbins. I knew him from social media, and he was Bud Hopkins' old assistant, right? He did he worked with Bud
for
on
people
all those cases.
Listening, let's just can what's the very quick Bud Hopkins Hopkins? We've discussed John Mack. He was a psychiatrist at Harvard. In a later stage of his life, he took on the abduction issue as a real, look like, close to heart issue, had a Galileo like experience with Harvard where they were like, you could better knock this off. So John Mack was an amazing scholar on that front. And Bud Hopkins was
one of the first guys that went and studied the abduction phenomenon. But Bud had kind of a, from what I hear and that he, like, the criteria, the evidence that he was getting was that this was no good, that they are to take advantage of humanity. And maybe some of them do. I don't think that this is all just one thing, right? I think there are different races involved. And even within the same race, I mean, what would you say if you is humanity a good and yeah.
Okay. Everybody's the same.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't have to really go any further. So but I think that Bud Hopkins was more of an alarmist, like David Jacobs was another one of his contemporaries.
Yeah, like where they 10, felt times like, 10.
Yeah. Yeah. Jacobs. They felt it was, that where it was an invasion. But John Mack was kind of, he had equanimity to himself and had more of a balance where I don't think that he thought that it was all good, that they were all saints. Cause I don't know that's if anybody's a saint, you know, all the time. But he also felt that, he knew that this was deeper and more convoluted than the way that I think Bud Hopkins was approaching it. And I love Bud Hopkins' work, and I would never say anything against him or Peter Robbins. Peter is just one of my dearest friends. But I think that, Peter, it was when I talked with him about what I had gone through. It was that I should ask, did I kind of cover the Bud Hopkins
Yeah, no, I think so. I think it's important. He was somebody that was a real pioneer in the abductions, in the study of abductions. Yes. Yeah,
and he developed a very good methodology too for
studying. And he was the guy that started the hypnotic regression, or he kind of that became his forte. Other people were using that method to get to locked memories. For instance, I mean, my wife doesn't remember anything that happened except for our room flooding with light three nights in a row.
Yeah,
everything else is like scrubbed from her memory. But thank God she remembers that much, because at least she knows I didn't go insane or something or lie. But anyway, Peter, he was helpful, but I still felt like something had happened to me and I didn't know how to deal with it. And I kept it to myself. I didn't share it with anybody for a few years. I would tell my new field investigators, because I felt like I owed them that little heads up that, you know, if you poke at the phenomenon, be careful, it may poke back, you know, and don't
sort of a hitchhiker, like almost like a hitchhiker. I mean, that phenomenon from Skinwalker Ranch and other things, you know, like if you're,
there's dark elements to this phenomena too. I mean, it's not all, you know, Reese's Pieces, you know. I mean, it's got some dark elements to it as well. Like, I mean, like we do, nothing is simple, you know.
Yeah.
And certainly
I think there are some rhesus monkeys that lived in labs that have some dark tales to tell too.
It was Reese's Pieces from the movie. They got E.T., me. You know,
I know. But it just spurred the thought of a rhesus monkey to me.
Well, that's what, you know, I mean, that's kind of what we are. I mean, what happens when you uplift, you know, primates? You go to the monkey cage and it's kind of an interesting thing, and it's kind of, you know, a distillation of what we are. And I think that there are visitors, at least this is my feeling, I think that the guys who are in charge are trying to change us so that we're ready for what's coming up, and that we're not a danger to the rest of the universe, you know, that we're not going to be marauders. I think Star Trek is perfect line with them, but Star Wars is anathema. They don't want that.
Was that something that felt like it was, was there a clarity to that post experience for you in regards to that? Not that there was any explicit messaging, because they didn't
speak
to you or try to communicate with you, but does that takeaway feel more kind of profound to you?
I knew Kathleen Martin, who's Betty and Barney Hill's niece. Here's another synchronicity. I mean, you know, I was like 8, 9 years old when that Look magazine came into the house. And I was the first time I ever felt the willies standing there and felt like the universe was caving in on me, because it's not the Great Gazoo. They might stick a needle in your navel.
Yeah.
I'd send a few cases to Kathleen Martin. She was heading up MUFON's experience or resource team at that time, with Dr. George Medich and Kathleen Martin, Dr. Don Dondery, and a few other people. Because they saw the need, because people would have face-to-face experiences and they would just have confusion, fear. There was no place for them to go, no place where people would listen to them, you know, and take them seriously. So I told of Kathleen, and I asked her if we could, and she went to town. She was speaking at the Alien Con thing in Pasadena. Mm-hmm. It was the first one they had.
Wearing the t-shirt.
Set for lunch, and I told her my story, and she was telling me things that absolutely made sense. I mean, I finally felt like other people have gone through this. I'm not the only one. I'm, you know, and she's listening to me with empathy and not so much advice. Just, again, you know, there's a catharsis in getting to tell your story and being taken seriously and not being ridiculed or laughed at. About an hour talking with her, and she was sharing, you know, that she had personal experiences too. See, it is generational.
Yeah.
She's met them as well. I told her, you know, I might like to join the ERT, you know, could I like maybe get interviewed or something for that?
And the ERT is
experience or resource team is what I, that's kind of, I mean, I do a few things at MUFON, but I think that my heart is very, very much into that.
Yeah.
And Kathleen's reply to me was, well, what do you think we were doing the last hour? Welcome to the ERT, you know. And that was about 4 years ago, and I took to it like a fish to water. And I started telling my story then, too. I felt more comfortable doing it. I felt, you know, that it's worth it if people want to lap me or, you know, do the Saturday Night Live thing. That's fine. But if it helps other people, yeah. That's what's important.
I've written some sketches I regret, too.
I would have, too. You know,
there's this this absurdity. I mean, I remember when Whitley Strieber's book came out, and it was, of course, this, you know, it struck a nerve. Of course, it struck a nerve. You know, this is, you know, there were probably so many people with similar experiences. And that was a harrowing tale. It was extremely exposing. It was a very and I think wrongly sort of created this idea that somehow people want, you know, coming forward with these stories is somehow, you know, a benefit to people, or that somehow there's some, you know, like profit to it, when in fact, you know, it can be very shameful to some people. Just assault in general is, you know, is such a personal, hard thing to discuss, much less an assault by something that, you know, is so outside of our, you know, experiences, or, you know, it's a double kind of whammy. And in our, what will be our subsequent episode with my friend Gene, I think all of this will be such a kind of, you know, reassurance for her.
You can equate it to rape trauma in a lot of ways. I mean, I know Whitley Strieber describes his experience as a rape experience.
People have a good experience, though. I mean, there's one gentleman who was a photographer for the national parks, and I have to be careful because I'm not going to, I have to redact people's names and stuff, but he was out in the middle of nowhere in the Badlands on top of this pinnacle about 150 feet up in the air, nowhere to run. And this flying saucer comes up, and there were three tall blonde beings that kind of Star Trek'd right up there with him on this ledge, and that he never felt such love in his life, that was just radiating from them. And the woman told him that he had been their charge, that they had been looking out for him all of his life, that he had a purpose here on earth. And for him, the trauma was that when they left, they didn't come back, and he missed his, you know, cosmic family. And I've heard similar stories, you know, many, you know, so it's not always a scary thing. Maybe I got that because of my mom being part of the military industrial complex, because that is what she came from.
I think what makes sense is something you touched on before, which is, you know, we are in a very, very big universe. Of course, there's life. Of course, it's mathematically impossible that there isn't life. Mm-hmm. And it's mathematically also likely impossible that there isn't just a multitude of life, and that what might be the disappointing part is we might be on the low end of the tech spectrum, and there's this teeming world. When people, you know, hear, or those that have heard our conversation with your friend Paul Hynek, you know, we've talked about different chemical gateways to potentially seeing entities. There's all sorts of, you meditate, you believe you kind of manifested it through meditation. Mm-hmm. And it's these access points to what could be just a multitude of species, mm-hmm. life, technological life that is just, you know, probably, you know, checking us out and with different agendas and different ideas of what to do with us, probably.
Yeah, well, I think we can tie it into David Gresh's revelations, because he clearly states non-human intelligences in the plural.
Yes.
Yeah.
It runs a gamut. I mean, you hear, you know, go and read, like, you know, I mean, even just reading Hynek's book, there's... just so many, it seems like, different species and subspecies. And I don't know if, you know, sometimes I don't even know if we're actually in the actual ETs. I mean, I think they may use avatar bodies or something.
Right.
Because you don't see them in spacesuits. I mean, this place, it must have, you know, bacteria and viruses that could kill them. So I don't know, you know, I mean, I try to be open-minded about all things, everything that's, you know, encapsulated with this giant field of ufology. I'm very careful about not becoming dogmatic about one idea or, you know, and I mean, even, you know, I tend to want to think that they're all space brothers, but they're not. I mean, it's you know, kind of a... you know, Mulligan stew or something, minestrone. There's like a bunch of different species that we're dealing with. And I think that perhaps there are different motives, different reasons for visiting us and why we, but I do think that the good guys are in charge because here we are. It's, you know, 75 years since the Roswell event and all that. And still, humanity is humanity's greatest threat still. You know, we're our own.
Yeah.
We've seen the enemy and he is us. It's like the old Pogo cartoon from back when.
And it's either nuclear weapons or social media. I'm not sure which will get us first.
It's the AI, Dave. Yeah. And it's, yeah. You know, yeah. It's AI. That's also passe, these threats. Yeah. You know, it's we need new ones, you know.
There was recently that article you sent me, Tom, that was out on Reddit, of somebody claiming to be a biologist studying the alien bodies and saying these, you know, and in that story saying, you know, we don't know if any of this is true, but the hypothesis that they are bioengineered, basically machines that are,
I mean, you know, I've heard that. You know,
yeah.
This was a post that I speak as a writer was if it was fiction and could very easily, absolutely no way to know whatever. It was the best. It was just like chef's kiss sci-fi writing. It was the most explicit medical breakdown of someone who had supposedly worked on these bodies with genomics and DNA and explicit. Science writing that would take me months and years to duplicate. It was the ultimate LARP live action role play. If in fact that's what it was, but it's a fascinating read and it made a lot of sense because it's sort of like, well, you know, you could send something that may be somewhat alive or somewhat, you know, kind of to deal with our craziness and, you know, lower the personal threat for yourself. But I do believe that it's interesting that, you know, even though we all have our echo chambers now, like the more I'm studying UFOs, the more UFO stuff seems to come, you know, and yet I do believe there is something about the AI thing that is arisen so kind of suddenly feels like, and now is sort of all around and ubiquitous and is also very threatening. So I, you know, we could misuse it so easily that could have stirred up, you know, more interest, or that could be why MUFON is a little busier and having more conversations and secret very locations busy. With Congress. And I think there's just this conversation has to continue. We would love to talk with you again. I think this was just amazing. And thank you for sharing your experience. And there's so many different, I mean, we could do a whole episode on your mom working for Howard Hughes. Like, that's incredible. And I'm so grateful to have you on, Earl, and our first live stream.
Oh, is that your mom?
Yeah.
My gosh.
There you go.
What was her name?
Betty Grace Anderson. Her maiden name was Maiden. You can imagine how, you know, talking about Social Security, whoever, your mother's maiden name. Maiden,
well, I see where you got your looks from.
Yeah, she's beautiful. She's beautiful.
Hey, my
and you're beautiful.
Okay. I thought you were insulting my mother.
She's a little she's a little more beautiful than you.
No, you're a handsome man. You've got
she's a classic beauty.
And she looks, she's beautiful.
Well, I'd love to come back, and best of luck to you guys in your endeavor. And I'm absolutely behind you. And it was an absolute pleasure being on your show. So
yeah, thanks. Hopefully sometime I'd love to visit with you, and I'd love to learn more about MUFON and its day-to-day.
Go get a beer sometime, yeah, or do it. Dinner or whatever.
Yeah, we'll do our beer. We'll do our beer episode.
Episode. Invite Paul Hynek because
it's a little more than beer.
No GMT though. No.
Yeah,
GMT.
I can't. I've already just your conversation alone. Not in any way to make light of your episode, but my wife is going to be like you. I'm going to have a whole I'm going to have a whole conversation with her about discussing UFOs, and she's like, because I don't want that to happen. I was like, well, I won't meditate.
No, don't invite them in. You're not supposed to invite the vampires in, right? That's like, phenomenology 101, but
I find that aspect so fascinating. And so that's something that we, hopefully we can discuss at another time. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Earl.
Thank you, guys. Just let me say, if anybody, if this has run a chord, for you, and it sounds familiar to you, you've experienced something like this, just go to MUFON, MUFON.com. On the frontest page, it'll say a report a craft or report a being. And you can do both, actually. They go kind of hand in hand. So. All right.
Perfect. Yep. Perfect. Thank you so much. And
thank you.
I want to remind our audience, don't forget to follow us on Instagram at @really_podcast_official. Subscribe to us on YouTube on the Stampede Podcast Network. That's the Stampede Podcast Network. And subscribe to our audio version everywhere podcasts are available. Dave, thank you, buddy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
This was great.
And just in time, because my visitor, which is a benignly enlarged prostate, is making demands.
Right. That's
right now.
Love
so
that.
I sense that
could be happening.
I'm going to check out now while my desk is still dry.
Yes, before this becomes a real live stream. Yeah. Right. So, okay.
I'll let you close up with Earl, Tom, and I'm going to go.
You just run. Just run away. We don't want to see it.
Thanks again, Earl.
Thank you, Dave.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.